brilliant young man with a lot of good ideas.
Comedy live from New York City via vacation. As the Off the Meter radio program, Jimmy Fallon, Dean Imperial, we're coming to you live, but from the future, or are we coming from the past? I don't understand.
Yeah, we're kind of like in a another zone, another dimension.
What you're listening to right now, and we thank you for listening, and we emphasize the word "you" in the singular sense because we don't get a lot of listeners. Let's
not
be
a lot
fair.
Of people listening.
It's not a ton.
Let's be honest about it.
Let's look this thing right in the eye and take it head on before I take my family on
a
vacation.
A man looks into the abyss, a.k.a. our audience.
Basically, what's going on here on the Off the Meter program is I'm getting ready to hit the road. I got a gig to do with Lisa Lampanelli. I've got a few jokes to tell at a couple of colleges. We're not going to be around next week. So Dean and I decided, you know, we'd put together a little bit of bonus content. We would interview a couple of New Yorkers, a couple of people anyway, that we found fascinating.
Yeah.
And we would supply you with some content while we were gone.
Mm-hmm.
You might wonder why we're doing this. Are we benevolent? Are we just, like, great at customer service? Are we that in touch with our audience? No, it's that we're not confident enough in any of our material to label it best of.
No.
I don't have an episode here that I'm going to call, oh, it's the best of.
Yeah.
Got to hear this one, bro.
Yeah, it takes a lot of gall to kind of go around saying that you got a best
that.
Of.
We don't have that in us. So when it's time for the Off the Meter program to go on vacation, yeah, we may not show up to the studio, but you are going to get fresh content. You tell us what the best of is.
Fresh content.
Yeah, it's fresh content.
It's like a fruit stand. We've got the freshest content.
You know what's funny about the fruit stand? You can actually tell when it's fresh by the prices. I'll give you a great example. Corner guy on 23rd Street. If you walk by and the bananas are three for a dollar, buy them. You got good bananas. If you walk by and they're six for a dollar, run the other way.
They're on the other way. Yeah,
he does
right.
it all the time. Yeah, yeah. I've noticed now, back from when I was driving a cab, that the prices would change because I'd go to the same guys all the time.
Yeah.
And the volume and the pricing would change.
Did you ever notice when you were driving a cab talking about fruit stands quickly that there are fruit stands in my neighborhood open 24 hours?
Yeah, I have
there
seen
are
it.
Guys sitting at fruit stands
sleeping there
at like 3 a.m. I'm like, what the hell are these guys doing? Who's buying fruit at 3 a.m.?
It's like the Christmas tree guy.
Yeah.
You ever see that Christmas tree guy? Like somebody's walking out of the bar, the bar, I'll get a tree.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, well, that actually, that could
happens.
Work. But you don't see a lot of like fruit. Fall down drunks get buying grapes.
I'm gonna get a papaya.
I'm gonna get an apple.
Very funny. So Dean and I were in good spirits, even though we have to work a little extra today for you, the listener, because we got Carl Gottlieb coming up on the show. If you're not familiar with Carl Gottlieb, you're definitely familiar with his work. The gentleman wrote The Jerk, which is a seminal film, one of my top three films of all time.
Me too, yeah.
He wrote The Jerk with Steve Martin.
Yep.
He also wrote a film called Jaws that you've probably heard of.
Well, the film that created the term blockbuster.
Yes, the summer blockbuster is owed to this gentleman, him and Steven Spielberg, of course.
Yeah.
Who originally, I believe, hired him to do punch-up on the script, you were telling me?
Yeah, well, he was actually hired to be in the movie.
Wow.
And then Peter Benchley, who wrote the novel, also wrote the screenplay. And then Spielberg thought, well, I think I should, you know, punch up this script and put some funny things in it. Okay. And there's an interesting fact about Gottlieb writing the script. He actually wrote his character out of it almost to service the script.
That's wild. We'll have to ask him about that.
Yeah.
You talk about a guy with screenwriting integrity.
Oh, yeah. No, this guy is all about integrity. He's like a... Yeah.
They hand me that script. I am now the love interest, the lead.
Right.
It would be called the Maltese Fela. I'd replace the Falcon with me.
Yeah, right.
This man has real integrity. We're about to interview a guy with real credits and real integrity. I don't know how we're going to pull this off.
He wrote Jaws.
Jaws. Think about
I wonder
that
how
for
much
a second.
Of the Murray Hamilton role, the mayor, he wrote. Because that's a funny character.
That's a great character. We're going to have to ask him. We're going to
ask
all
him.
Of this. He, of course, is stopping by today via the Google Voice line, ladies and gentlemen, because he has a fantastic new book coming out. You're going to hear me say this a couple of times. It's called The Little Blue Book for Filmmakers. He wrote it with his partner, Tony Attell. I have had them on the phone in the past on the show about a couple of months ago. Great interview, great guy, but we talked so much about the book. And it is a fantastic book, and we'll get into that in a little while. But today, because we've got a little more time and we're not doing this in our strict radio format, we're going to do the hits. You know what I mean? You know, this is like you're going to go see him in concert.
Yeah,
we're going to do the hits. We're going to get through The Jerk. We'll get through Jaws. You know, we'd love to get into a short film, The Absent-Minded Waiter.
Which with Steve Martin, which is great.
There's a lot to talk about with Carl Gottlieb, so we should probably just go talk to Carl Gottlieb. Off the meter,
off the meter. With Jimmy Fallon.
I wish he could have been with me when I sat with a group of teenagers who were black.
You know what we should have gotten from outro music? Music from The Jerk, the end of The Jerk, the gospel.
Oh, my life.
I know you must
have. Nowhere.
I know you must have looked for it.
Come on.
You had the same thought.
Fucking 2 hours. On this. We're going to play Jaws. Go fuck yourself. Coming to you live from New York City. It's the Off the Meter radio program. Jimmy Fallon, Dean Imperial, getting ready to welcome a very special guest to this program. For this program, this is like our Super Bowl. You know how like New York City is hosting the Super Bowl in 2014?
Oh, yeah. I can't think of a better guest for this show.
We're hosting ours today, so let's go ahead and do this. Joining us now on the phone, not only has he written a few of our favorite movies, a few of your favorite movies,
The
listener, but he's got a fantastic new book out. It is called The Little Blue Book for Filmmakers. He wrote it with his partner, Tony Attell. Please welcome the fantastic, the great Carl Gottlieb to the show. How you doing, Carl?
I'm well, thank you, and yourselves?
You know what? We're better now, man. You are a hero for doing this show. Like, this is really great for us, so thank you, thank you.
Okay, a lot of heroes would have to, like, you know, plunge into burning buildings and stop railroad trains running away, but if I can sit here and answer the phone and be a hero.
That works for us.
Carl, the bar's been lowered considerably in 2013. you just got to pick up the phone. But no, thank you for joining us. I have my producer, Dean Imperial, in studio as well. And obviously, great fans of your work. We read the book. We're going to get into all of that today. But we have to start with a question. I don't know if you get this question a lot. But who came up with the name Iron Balls McGinty?
I think that was probably, I'd love to be able to say, oh, you know, I wrote that. It was a gag I created. But when when I played the part, you know, when I was one of the four guys who Steve dispatches for being, you know, prejudiced fellows, I'm saved for last. He gives me a tremendous kick in the groin. And I guess, you know, then I would say Carl and Steve Martin added, you know, the heavy clank of a... And then in the next scene, the very next cut, Bernadette is saying to Steve, you know, oh, don't worry, honey. You had no way of knowing that was Iron Balls McGinty. So I was prepped for it in the fight scene. You know, they said, now, you're not going to wrestle with him. You're not going to get thrown around. You know, you just stand there and just take that kick. It was a real, no stuntmen involved. That was really Steve. That was really me. That was really my crotch.
So it's very interesting because you have a history as a screenwriter of changing your own part and not necessarily for the better. On your end, you know, here in Iron Balls McGinty, and of course in the Jaws, you famously diminished your own role in the movie when you rewrote Jaws. That's true, right?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, in this instance, I think I added to my role because nobody remembers the names of the other guys who got beat up thrown in the pool.
Yeah.
One of them is Lenny Montana, who was Luca Brasi in The Godfather.
Oh, right, right.
The only one you remember is Iron Balls, because of that great name.
It was
that was actually padding my part and my groin.
Yeah,
and your groin. That's very funny. It's a particularly interesting name for us because in New York right now we're having a fantastic mayoral race, and Anthony Weiner famously had one of the greatest pseudonyms, Carlos Danger. We've been talking about that all summer, and someone told us Iron Balls McGinty is the only equivalent to Carlos Danger if you were going to be sexting as a mayoral candidate. So you got that going for you.
Yeah, yeah, I'm kind of staying away from tweeting and texting.
Trying to cut down.
Part.
Oh.
Yeah, Carlos Danger. That's a name I could live with as a handle.
Yes, isn't it great? It's fantastic. It's good for a wrestler. It's good for anything. But it's perfect.
Yeah.
From a writing standpoint, it was a pretty good creation, I think.
Yeah,
Carlos Danger.
I follow that. You know, I'm a born New Yorker, mm-hmm. so I stay in touch with the goings on. And the great thing about that episode, apparently it's ongoing.
Yeah,
is the nature of New York politics, and New Yorkers take that stuff in stride and go, yeah, right, Carlos Danger exposes himself. is he a good mayor? You know, apparently hasn't hurt him that much in the polls.
No, he's hanging in there. And, no pun intended, he's hanging in there. But it is very funny, and we've had an interesting summer because it's basically he's a field day for the headline writers. You know, if you like puns, this is your Super Bowl this summer. It has been nonstop Anthony Weiner puns around the block. If I was 12 years old, this would be the greatest summer of my life.
Oh, that you'd be, Weiner, why Diener? it's just on and on and on.
Hey, hold on a second. Do you work for the New York Post by any chance?
No. I was a faithful reader when I lived in New York, but that was because it was always available on a seat in the subway, or on somebody would always leave it on a park bench. Post is not somehow is a paper you don't take home with you.
You know, it's funny. There's an old adage. It says, "I only buy Hustler magazine, so I have something to hide the Post in."
Yes,
that's what we're doing. If you just joined us, we're talking to Carl Gottlieb on the phone. Did you have something, Dean?
No, I was going to ask Carl, how long were you in New York, and when did you move to Los Angeles?
Well, I was born and raised in the city, in the LaGuardia World era.
Okay.
And went to grammar school and high school in the first 2 years at CCNY uptown.
Okay.
At the 135th Street campus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, know it well.
Townsend Harris Hall and all that. And then I transferred to Syracuse University, and then I got drafted and I went away to the U.S. Army for a couple of years, and then I went to San Francisco, and I came back to New York for the theatrical season of 1965, and had a wonderful time. Then went back to San Francisco, and then moved to L.A. So first third of my life was I was a New Yorker. I say I qualify for dual
citizenship.
You're in. I'll make a few phone calls. I'll throw my weight around. Go ahead.
Okay.
When you were in San Francisco, at what point did you get involved with the committee?
That's why I went. I joined them a few months after they opened in 1963. I was a stage manager. I directed the company. I went to New York, and severed my connections with the committee for a year, and went back as an actor, and that, changed my life because it was 1966. It was San Francisco, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was all of that.
And the Grateful Dead, too. Didn't they used to perform there?
Sure. There was a movie shot there during that period that Richard Lester directed called Petulia.
Oh, wow.
And that movie is distinguished by many. First of all, everybody in the committee is in it. Everybody I knew in San Francisco is in that movie. Wow. But also, it's in that movie, The Grateful Dead, The Jefferson Airplane, and Big Brother and The Holding Company all perform.
Oh, we got to see. Well, Richard Lester directed all the Beatles movies.
Yeah.
And then you can see those acts performing in the background.
Oh, that's great.
It's got to have a good soundtrack. It's got to have a really good soundtrack. So you made a move, basically, all right, from you're in the committee now.
Started as an actor.
Yeah, you started as an actor. How did you wind up working on Jaws?
Well, I came to L.A. As an actor because the committee opened an edition of the show in Los Angeles. We opened a second company on the Sunset Strip, and we were very successful. And while I was there, if you're successful in Los Angeles in live theater and you're performing six nights a week, you're probably going to get seen by various casting directors and producers.
Wow.
And I was seen and spotted and hired by the Smothers Brothers, who were looking for new writers for their comedy variety television show.
Okay.
Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, they also found Steve Martin and Bob Einstein.
Wow.
And Brendan created the Newhart show in Rhoda. Rob Reiner. There was a whole bunch of us who got our start and our first Writers Guild cards that show.
Can I ask you a question? So you're at the Smothers Brothers show, and you reference all of this talent. When you're around that level of talent, are you aware that you're around something, you know, that's kind of a different caliber? Like, in that moment, can you tell there's some type of creative vibe going on that's very unique?
You have a slight sense of it. I mean, obviously, you're buried in the work of turning out a show every week.
Uh-huh.
You know, rehearsing one, shooting another, writing a third.
Uh-huh.
It's a complex exercise. But and you know, in amongst the geniuses, there were a few not geniuses.
Yeah.
Hey.
But it was a great place to work, and you're constantly saying, especially for those of us who were new in it, you know, we had no basis for comparison. We hadn't labored on the Red Stone Show or the Colgate Comedy Hour or Hilton Burrell, the other variety shows, television. So, you know, it was all kind of new to us, and it was experimental, and the Smothers Brothers were willing to try whatever crazy ideas we came up with. So between us and Laugh-In, it was kind of like being in Saturday Night Live 5 years later in New York in 75 when they went on the air.
Yeah, yeah,
just had a sense of, wow, this is pretty cool.
Wow.
And we won the Emmy that year for Best Comedy. We beat out Laugh-In. They had collected the Emmy for two previous seasons.
Wow.
And when they there we were at the Emmy Awards and for Best Comedy Musical Variety Show, and the Laugh-In people were standing up ready to go on.
Oh, that's great.
Good for you.
And they said, Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and then we went up.
It was wow.
Great fun.
You socked it to him.
That's got
to
be some feeling.
Yeah.
I got a question about the transition into, because they hired you as a performer / writer, and did your writing muscle come from improvisation originally?
Yes. Well, I was always a writer. I mean, I was always the sly with words. I was a writer in high school. I won, whatever award they give in high school for creative. I was a journalism and theater major at Syracuse. I had a weekly column in the Syracuse University daily newspaper because they had a journalism school. They turned out a daily every day. It was actually, semi-competitive with the regular Newhouse publications in Syracuse.
Wow.
Little Journal.
That's
whatever. Bugle Post, Intelligence, or whatever the names of the papers.
Right.
The squaw. You beat out the Onondaga squaw. Way to go, Carl. Way to go.
So I was always a writer, and then when I was in New York, after I'd been a stage manager and a director, while I was in New York, I sold my first big, slick magazine article to Esquire magazine.
Oh, cool.
And that was cool.
What was it about?
So I was like always a writer, and then as an improviser, you're essentially writing standing up. You're just not taking the time to put it down on paper.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I was hired as a writer because I was coming up with all these funny lines and funny ideas on stage. I had an improvisational company of actors that I was working with, but then I was working with a company of very funny writers and comedians. Two or three of them were stand-ups. Steve Martin was a stand-up. John Hartford was a singer-songwriter from Nashville who did a very funny, stand-up solo music act.
Mm.
Murray Roman, who was a...
The late Murray Roman, yeah.
That was great.
Murray Roman.
Well, can I ask you this question? Was Steve Martin, of all these people you've been around, was he the most transformative guy? In terms of a guy who had an energy in a room that really separated himself from the other acts.
Yes and no. His energy in the room was rather low key because Steve is not a guy who is on when he's off stage.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
His personality and demeanor have always been kind of dry and restrained, extremely funny.
Yeah.
And when it came time to pitch jokes or perform them, he obviously
flipped the switch.
Superlative. but he was not a tumbler. And Murray Roman was always, you know, yakking it up, and Bob Einstein, you know, Super Dave.
Yeah, Super Dave Osborne, Albert Brooks' brother, right?
Yeah, the you know, me, we were always, you know, spritzing. But then when the time, you know, after a certain amount of spritzing, the head writers say, okay, go and write it. And then you go lock yourself in a room with your, either alone or with a partner. Wow. And render on paper what it was that made people laugh in the room.
Oh, so you often wrote with a partner?
Yeah, yeah.
Who did you usually write with?
A Lorenzo Music.
Ah, wow.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So, as a matter of fact, we wrote a monologue for Bob Newhart when he did the show. You know, so much in his vernacular that he bought it from us to use in his act for years after that.
Oh, that's great.
Wow, that's so cool.
And that was, Lorenzo used that connection as an entree with a different writing partner, Dave Davis, to create the first Bob Newhart show.
Oh, wow.
Oh, man.
You know, Lorenzo had impressed with the sketch and then went on to write the Newhart show. And was very, you know, was very generous about acknowledging the fact that we had written this successful comedy bit had got him in the door.
Wow. That's fantastic stuff. And the famous story I'm trying to clarify is that, you know, when you got the part to punch up Jaws, you were essentially doing punch up and you became the screenwriter. How did that go down?
Well, I was hired. You know, Stephen and I were friends, and we had written stories together to sell. You know, we had pitched film ideas together. Mm-hmm. Weren't able to sell any of them. Steve was locked in to direct, and nobody would take some. You know, a new director and new writer. Uh-huh. So, but we were, you know, we knew each other's story sense and creative talents, and. I had worked in a couple of his TV movies, just doing a day part here and there, kind of improvising my own lines. Mm-hmm. If the screenwriter hadn't given Steven what he wanted, they said, "Well, you know, if it's going to be a long shoot, and if you're there as an actor, you know, for you know, look through the script, see if you see a part that you'd like." And I did. The publisher of the paper was kind of one of the co-conspirators with Murray Hamilton.
Yeah.
Of the town. I was one of the wicked townspeople who were all for covering up the shark attack. So I got hired as an actor. Because he says, you know, and while, you know, you'll be down there, and if you're not in the scene, you can help with the extras, and we can talk about, you know, what's, you know, other stuff. And then he sent me a copy of the then existing script with a note on it saying, "Eviscerate this."
Well, Peter Benchley wrote the screenplay, right?
This was Peter Benchley wrote the original screenplay adaptation from his own novel.
Right.
And then a screenwriter named Howard Sackler took Peter's work, which was essentially a novelist's idea of how a screenplay. I mean, Peter Benchley had never written a screenplay, and it was just another way of compensating him for purchasing the book, although nobody expected to shoot his screenplay.
Okay.
And so they hired Howard Sackler to do a real screenplay, but it wasn't very satisfactory, and it had a lot of holes and flaws, and I pointed them out in a memo, and Stephen showed the memo to Zanuck and Brown, and they asked me to join them for coffee one morning 3 weeks before the picture started shooting, and we got into a long, long conversation about the script, and they said, "Well, maybe we should hire you as a writer. Can you leave tomorrow?"
You wrote another great book called The Jaws Log.
Yes.
I have, and it's one of the great books about the movie making process.
Yeah, that was as a you know. So I went there. My contract was for a 1 week dialogue polish.
Oh wow.
The writer, and then they just kept extending it week after week after week, and what was started as a dialogue polish turned into just a major reworking of the screenplay continually evolving writing process with the director and the actors as this movie was shooting.
Wow.
I mean, I wouldn't recommend it as a way to make a movie.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb and say it worked.
Yeah, it turned out okay.
Yeah, not having the working shark also worked in his favor.
I mean, yeah, I'd like to point out that, you know, they didn't have the ending when they wrote Casablanca either.
Right. Right.
That's incredible, man. I mean, it's got to blow your mind. I mean, even now, to think back on the on some of these successes. You know. I mean, Jaws is—it's just such a seminal thing. If you play the theme from Jaws anywhere in the world, they know what you're referencing. You know, it's. Did you ever think about it and just wow?
Yeah, I know. Tony Attell, and you know, my partner, when she does her act, mm-hmm. she used to reference the movie. She'd say, "Well, you know, a lot of those people, like, when they heard that music, they should have gotten out of the water." I mean, you know.
That's good.
It's their fault. It's their fault. Well,
he was playing.
That's too funny. If you're just joining us, Carl Gottlieb's on the horn. We're talking about all of his great work. We're going to get to his book here in a minute. Did you have another one, Dean?
Well, you know, and I wanted to ask about, but I think we're going to get. I wanted to ask, not to backtrack too much, but how did you meet Steven Spielberg?
After the committee opened in Los Angeles, I met a girl who lived in Los Angeles, and we sort of lived together, and then we got married.
Oh boy!
And we had a house that was kind of convenient for everybody in Hollywood. I mean, it's just the location. Uh-huh. If you know Los Angeles, it's around the corner from a store called the Guitar Center on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. And in those days, the Guitar Center wasn't there, but the location was kind of midway between Laurel Canyon and Beverly Hills, and all the recording studios in Hollywood, where every record act made music and all. I had a lot of friends in the music business.
Wow.
And a lot of filmmakers also lived in Laurel Canyon. I mean, Laurel Canyon is its own destination.
Right.
We had kind of an open house. People would just come and hang out and, you know.
Wow. That's incredible.
Enjoy conversation as well. And I had the same agent as Steven. We had a young hustling agent at ICM at that time, mm-hmm. named Mike Savoy, who went on to become a great producer.
Wow.
But he was a young agent who was hustling and understood the value of packaging, and he kept putting his clients together in different combinations. Mm-hmm. And Mike Medavoy's class of 68, that year he signed me from the committee, Steven Spielberg, who had just done the successful little short subject that got him a TV contract job at Universal, John Milius, Carol Eastman, Michelangelo Antonioni.
Oh, wow. It's quite a class.
it was and Steven and I wound up, you know, he was new in Hollywood. He hadn't grown up here, or he had come here, you know, to make movies. Mm-hmm. And I was already connected a little bit to the filmmaking community. I had done a documentary where I work with a lot of the underground filmmakers, mm-hmm. and Steven was working the studio system, mm-hmm. and we just, you know, the agent said, why don't you write some stuff together and I'll send you out on meetings, which we did. Mm-hmm. So we got to working together, and we were essentially social pals and members of a creative community.
Wow.
That's, you know, that hardly exists anymore, except in pockets, you know, the USC graduates, the West Ham graduates, the East Coast Harvard Lampoon guys. Yeah. There's always these small cliques, but at that time there was just kind of a one size fits all. It was just like a community of writers and directors and filmmakers, and just as there was a community of actors and
that's interesting.
And, who worked in television, it was a smaller, more wild place.
Yeah, it's wild. In New York, we have that with our comedy scene. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody kind of knows each other, but it's definitely become more fragmented.
Yeah, absolutely.
But your book, which we should mention to the listeners, is fantastic. It's called The Little Blue Book for Filmmakers. You wrote mm-hmm. it with Tony Attell. Your book is very today in that you guys go to great lengths to explain how to navigate the terrain of today's landscape, if you're trying to make it in the industry. How much has this changing landscape affected your approach to making it in Hollywood, you know, as you say in the book? You know, is it different, or a lot of the same axioms that were true back then true today?
Some are, some aren't. I mean, the sense of community is not what it was.
Yeah.
People are really out for themselves. There's not much sharing going on.
Mm-hmm.
When Stephen and I were coming up, you thought nothing of sharing opportunities that you heard about with your friends. You know, yeah. This place is hiring television writers. Oh, hey, they're casting an actor.
Yeah.
You know, there's two actors who I used to run into at commercials auditions all the time. Michael Lerner and Oliver Ollie Clark.
Because
we were like the funny fat guys.
We wouldn't know anything about that.
And we'd be often, in the same casting room when they were looking for an actor of our type.
Uh-huh.
And we would think nothing of just saying, hey, have you been over to see about, some television show that's hiring? Have you been over to, I don't know.
Yeah, which is funny I think you're basically going to say that right now they don't do that as much, and I know they don't do it here.
No, I
got to tell you a funny story.
Information is hoarded, not shared.
Yes,
right.
It's a very funny story. I went into read for a part for a CBS sitcom, and when I got there and signed the guest book, there were 8 comics in the login book that I had spent the previous night with, and none of us mentioned it to each other. And the running joke was I texted them on the way out of there, like, so how'd it go? And they all responded with, like, what are you talking about? And I realized, right then and there, what type of game I'm playing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you really just brought it full circle for me. That's really funny. One of the things we talked about the last time I had you on, which I thought was fascinating, is you said there were ways that could guarantee you wouldn't get any work. Meaning if you were a director and you labeled a talent, I think you said it was difficult, they just wouldn't get work anymore. That's what it was?
Yeah, that's the one of the curses of that time was, that the power was concentrated in very few hands. There were, seven studios and 3 networks.
Yeah.
And if you were persona non grata at 1 or 2 or 3 of those places,
was it?
The others would kind of hear about it.
Yeah.
Because even though they weren't supposed to, the top executives, of course, never met because they were, they were out to kill each other.
Uh-huh.
But subordinates would meet their counterparts from the other companies, just as a matter of self-preservation. You could,
to know what was going on.
You had an actor who was habitually, drunk and abusive on the set.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you could tell your competitor, you should hire that guy. He's great. But if you were responsible to your company and if you knew you might be at that other studio sometime, you'd say, when that drunk and abusive actor's name would come up, you'd kind of roll your eyes. He can be a little difficult.
Oh.
And that was shorthand for, stay away.
Wow. So there's code. Let me ask you this, because I get that. Being labeled as difficult would be, an immediate death sentence for an act. Is there something an act can do that actually exponentially increases their hireability? I mean, beyond like talent or great looks, is there something out there that they're looking for from an act, like a fundamental?
Oh boy, there's certain fundamentals of human behavior, which is it's summed up, I think, is it Google or Facebook? The slogan, don't be evil.
Yeah.
There's a huge, I forget which of the great new startups, one of the multi-billion dollar giants. It's Google or Facebook or Amazon, all of those, has the slogan, don't be evil.
Yeah. That's a start.
And it's good advice. Mm-hmm. Even in biblical terms do unto others. I mean, if you can be a decent human being, that goes a long way, because you know people want to work with you again. They don't. They know that you're not going to put yourself so far ahead of them that you'll trash production just to make yourself look better.
Yeah, it's
you won't. And it's a very fine line. I mean, there are actors like Dustin Hoffman who's very particular about his performance and his scripts, and he will bother you to death about rewriting and polishing and why is the character doing this and why is this here, and he'll nitpick all those decisions up to a point, and then when it's time to deliver a performance, mm-hmm. he puts on his Raymond suit and does an incredible job.
Yeah.
And is not disagreeable. So people hire him again.
Now that makes sense. Because one of the things.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. I was going to mention another actor, but it's in the negative, so maybe I best not.
All right, we'll play
something good there.
We'll give you that. We'll do this one off the air. You can give us the director's cut when we hang up with our listeners. One of the observations I had made to Dean is that in the limited exposure I've had to wildly successful people, they are all very low maintenance. They operate with a level of efficiency and they're very positive. That's what I've found in my limited experience. Is that what you've found, you know, when you're dealing with the upper echelons of Hollywood? Are they pretty low maintenance, get it right people?
Most of them, yeah. I mean, the personal character traits mm-hmm. that make for a successful artist, which is, you know, ability to focus, mm-hmm. ability to keep the picture in mind, you don't get distracted. These are all virtues in life as well as art.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the rules for improvisation are essentially the rules of life. Listen, don't negate, cooperate on stage. These are all
basic stuff.
Teams that make you, a decent human being and somebody that people like to work with, because when you're a decent human being and you're cooperating with other decent human beings, and add to that talent and ability and artistic sensibility, then the collective very often has the sum is greater than the parts. I mean, all the writers on Saturday Night Live 5 years were terrific, but the product, individually they might have been crazy or difficult or unmanageable or ego-driven, but together the product was something that was better than all of them working by themselves.
Yeah. I get it. That makes sense.
People like Chevy Chase proved when they went off by themselves.
Yeah.
That's funny. Well, let me ask you this question. First, let's pull it together. But I wanted to ask you this question because you've been around seminal films yourself. I mean, you wrote, to be fair, these are seminal movies.
Oh, yeah,
I acted in the movie Bash.
You worked with Robert Altman.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Do you have, I was just going to ask you this, do you have a favorite film that you're not involved in?
Or a list?
Yeah, or some type of list compiled in your head that you rattle off?
Oh, movies I wish I had done?
That's interesting,
that's a great
too.
One,
yeah.
Too. Do you have one of them?
Indiana Jones. I mean, the first one, such a great, pastiche of a bygone studio era that I loved as a kid, which was the movie serials and the high stories of high adventure.
Yeah.
I mean, all of us of a certain age, when we went into the movies, we really wanted to make movies with pirates and cowboys and
the kid stuff, right?
Dueling for the hand of the girl. I mean, that's what we kind of signed up for.
Yeah.
And we wound up doing stuff that may or may not have been that, but we all loved the movies. One of the decisions I made after Jaws came out and I was working on Which Way Is Up with Richard Pryor, I was asked to go to New York to be the head writer of Saturday Night Live.
Wow.
Herb Sargent job. because I'd worked with Lorne Michaels on a Flip Wilson special.
Oh, wow.
Between the time I finished shooting Jaws and the time Jaws came out, I had still earned a living. Mm-hmm. I had quit my job at the Odd Couple on staff.
Yeah.
So I wasn't welcome back there. I took writing jobs as they came along. Mm-hmm. And I did a Flip Wilson special for NBC, and the executive producer was Lorne Michaels. And we got along great together, and he said, I'm going to do this new show in New York. And we had talked about what we would do if we had our own variety show.
Yeah.
And we described, a lot of the elements of Saturday Night Live. And I said, boy, that sounds great.
Wow.
And then when he got the deal, he said, do you want to come? And I thought long and hard about that one. Ultimately, I made the right choice because everybody who did the show in 1980 came to L.A. looking for screenwriting jobs. I already had three movies produced and was working on another one that I was going to direct.
Right.
I picked the right momentum, the right track.
You stayed ahead of the curve.
And it's blind luck. I mean, I would have had a completely different life. I have no idea what would have happened if I went to New York that year.
Good Lord.
That's
fantastic.
It's a real interesting to contemplate, but eventually, you're stuck with the life you lead, and I've been lucky enough to have a good one, so I really
not at all.
I complain about other people, but not about my choices.
No, and you that's funny, and you managed to bang out another great book with Tony Attell that we've been
the book for filmmakers is a very deliberate entry level book for people who are coming into the business and who are serious about making movies and it's not even movies anymore, making entertainments. You can the book is as you pointed out, it's pitched case business. Do we talk about the digital era? We talk about making short webisode kinds of product projects.
It's top to bottom. Go ahead.
The rules are the same. They figured out over the last 110 years how to make movies, and you can't ignore that experience. There's historical precedent for almost everything we do.
Yeah,
it's fascinating. But the in the book itself it's essentially a textbook. It's almost its own case study in all things entertainment. And I'm sure that's the direction it's heading in. You basically, people listening to the show are going to be, it's going to be probably required reading in their college someday.
Any NYU student should probably read it, or UCLA or USC.
If they're not doing that already, I would imagine they're going to contact you about that at some point.
If the publisher is doing his or her job, yes.
Right.
Well, all right. Well, I don't know about the publisher, but the publicist is kind of half-assing it because you wound up on this show today. But we appreciate you taking time to talk to us, Carl.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I always like to talk to you guys.
No, it was great. We really like you. And it was good because we had more time and you sang the hits for us today. We have so many questions. We kind of take you hostage on this show because most of our interviews are supposed to be 15 to 20 minutes. And somehow we managed to squeeze 40 minutes out of you. So for that, you are a saint, my friend. You are a saint.
And, I am wrung out dry. I have nothing left. Thank God nobody else wants to talk to me today.
Shut off your ringer, Carl, but thank you so much. Thank you so much, man.
All right, and regards to your audience, and if they like what we do, Little Blue Book for Filmmakers.
Dean and I are going to put on our sandwich board right now, and we'll parade in and out of Times Square for a little while.
Oh, just put it up on the website. That'll be
it. Thanks. It's rainy today, so I appreciate that. Thank you so much, Carl.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
There he went, Carl Gottlieb, everybody. The best of the best. I mean, for us.
Yeah, he's like a feast of stories. And, we could have talked to him for another hour.
For you, the listener, it's he's guys talking about hanging out with Steven Spielberg as like a 20-year-old.
And being offered the job as head writer for Saturday Night Live.
Think about that.
And he threw out that he was like working with Richard Pryor on a screenplay.
His throwaway was Richard Pryor.
This guy was like one of those seminal characters like Terry Southern that was like had his pulse on the hippest things of the time.
Yeah.
Jaws, The Jerk, Saturday Night Live.
Think about this. He's that dialed in. Because, I mean, we could really wind up Twinkie munching and kissing the guy's hands and sounding like jerks, but it's true.
No.
That he is that dialed in. I mean, do you know who you have to be to get offered the head writer's job at the inception of Saturday Night Live?
Oh, you got to be, like,
considered
the hippest guy.
You
got to
be considered the best of the best. Dean and I somehow just managed... to talk to the best of the best.
We
shout out Jamie Nelson, the publicist, for this fantastic book, The Little Blue Book for Filmmakers with Tony Attell. We implore you, the listener, to buy this book. I've read the book. I got to tell you something, man. I'm very good at interviewing people and making it sound like I read the book.
Yes.
I read this book, and I have no interest in directing or anything. And it's not a book specifically about directing. It's about every facet of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Web series, sketch, improv, directing. But the point was, it was impossible not to find it compelling because of the pedigree of the guy writing it.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, here's a window into the psychology of a guy who is responsible for the summer blockbuster.
Right.
Every newscast on Monday on a radio show ends with the box office numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this guy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, exactly.
The Lone Ranger tanked. You're talking about it because of this guy.
We care because
Superman
of this guy.
Killed because of this guy. You know, you're getting these stats on Monday radio shows because of this guy.
He wrote the first blockbuster.
Yeah, if this guy is responsible for radio show prep. He's responsible for a facet of show prep when you do news on the radio and so much more. But what a cool guy.
Cool guy.
And the reason we're going to get him back on the show, because he doesn't need us, but he alluded to the funny fat guy role because that's what he was always getting.
There's another layer of interview that we've got to...
We got to talk food with Carl.
Because we didn't really get into the details of The Jerk. We didn't talk to the absent-minded waiter. There's so much to talk about.
No, there's so much. And the point is, we had the guy on the phone for a month. He gave us what he gave us. He's actually killing his publicist right now. Right now. But Carl Gottlieb, if you're out there listening, we thank you.
Thank you.
Dean and I thank you. And of course, we thank you, the listener, for tuning in to this vacation edition of Off the Meter.
Oh, the buzzing of the bees and the cigarette trees, the soda water fountain, where the lemonade springs and the bluebird sings in that big rock candy mountain. On a summer's day in the month of May, a burly bum come a-hiking down a shady lane near the sugar cane. He was looking for his liking. As he strolled along, he sung a song of a land of milk and honey, where a bum can stay for many a day, and he won't need any money. Oh, 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 the buzzing of the bees and the cigarette trees, the soda water fountain, where the lemonade springs and the bluebird sings in that big rock candy mountain. In the big rock candy mountain, the cops have wooden legs, the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, the barns are full of hay. I want to go where there ain't no snow, where the sleet don't fall and the wind don't blow, in that big rock candy mountain. Oh, the buzzing of the bees and the cigarette trees, the soda water fountain, where the lemonade springs and the bluebird sings in that big rock candy mountain. The buzzing of the bees and the cigarette trees, the soda water fountain where the lemonade springs and the bluebird sings in that big rock candy mountain.
Off the meter, off the meter. With Jimmy Fallon.
I enjoyed it. It was an unbelievably interesting experience.